let the name stand and the wagering continue. On the edge of the wall, an ornate brass Moorish eye stood on three spindly legs. Maester Aemon had once used it to peer at the stars, before his own eyes had failed him. John swung the tube down to have a look at the foe. Even at this distance there was no mistaking Mance Raider's huge white tent, sewn together from the pelts of snow bears. The Moorish lenses brought the wildlings close enough for him to make out faces. Of Mance himself he saw no sign this morning, but his woman, Darla, was outside tending the fire, while her sister Val milked a she-goat beside the tent. Darla looked so big it was a wonder she could move. A child must be coming very soon, John thought. He swiveled the eye east and searched amongst the tents and trees till he found the turtle. That will be coming very soon as well. The wildlings had skinned one of the dead mammoths during the night, and they were lashing the raw, bloody hide over the turtle's roof, one more layer on top of the sheepskins and pelts. The turtle had a rounded top and eight huge wheels, and under the hides was a stout wooden frame. When the wildlings had begun knocking it together, Saturn thought they were building a ship. Not far wrong. The turtle was the hull turned upside down and opened fore and aft, a long haul on wheels.
"It's done, isn't it?" asked Gren.
"Near enough." John shoved away the eye. "It will come today, most like. Did you fill the barrels?"
"Every one. They froze hard during the night. Pip checked."
Gren had changed a great deal from the big, clumsy, redneck boy John had first befriended. He had grown half a foot, his chest and shoulders had thickened, and he had not cut his hair nor trimmed his beard since the fist of the first men. It made him look as huge and shaggy as an oryx, the mucking name that Sir Alistair Thorne had hung on him during training. He looked weary now, though. When John said as much, he nodded.
"I heard their axes all night. Couldn't sleep for all the chopping."
"Then go sleep now."
"I don't need. You do. I want you rested. Go on. I'm not going to let you sleep through the fight."
He made himself smile.
"You're the only one who can move those bloody barrels."
Gren went off muttering, and John returned to the far eye, searching the wildling camp. From time to time an arrow would sail past overhead, but he learned to ignore those. The range was long, and the angle was bad. The chances of being hit were small. He still saw no sign of Mance Raider in the camp, but espied Tormund Giantsbane and two of his sons around the turtle. The sons were struggling with the mammoth hide, while Tormund gnawed on the roast leg of a goat and bellowed orders. Elsewhere he found the wildling skin-changer, Varamyr Sixskins, walking through the trees with his shadow cat dogging his heels. When he heard the rattle of the winch chains and the iron groan of the cage door opening, he knew it would be Hub bringing their breakfast as he did every morning. The sight of Mance's turtle had robbed John of his appetite. Their oil was all but gone, and the last barrel of pitch had been rolled off the wall two nights ago. They would soon run short of arrows as well, and there were no Fletchers making more. And the night before last, a raven had come from the west, from Sir Denis Malister. Bowen Marsh had chased the wildlings all the way to the Shadow Tower, it seemed, and then farther, down into the gloom of the gorge. At the Bridge of Skulls he had met the Weeper and 300 wildlings and won a bloody battle. But the victory had been a costly one. More than 100 brothers slain, among them Sir Andrew Tarth and Sir Allardale Winch. The old pomegranate himself had been carried back to the Shadow Tower, sorely wounded. Maester Mullen was tending him, but it would be some time before he was fit to return to Castle Black. When he had read that, John had dispatched Zay to Molestown on their best horse, to plead with the villagers to help man the wall. She never returned. When he sent Molly after her, he came back to report the whole village deserted, even the brothel. Most likely Zay had followed them, straight down the King's Road. "Maybe we should all do the same," John reflected glumly. He made himself eat, hungry or no. Bad enough he could not sleep,
He could not go on without food as well. Besides, this might be my last meal. It might be the last meal for all of us. So it was that John had a belly full of bread, bacon, onions, and cheese when he heard Horse shout, "It's coming!" No one needed to ask what it was, nor did John need the maester's Moorish eye to see it creeping out from amongst the tents and trees. "It doesn't really look much like a turtle," Saturn commented. "Turtles don't have fur." "Most of them don't have wheels either," said Pip. "Sound the war horn," John commanded, and Keggs blew two long blasts to wake Gren and the other sleepers who'd had the watch during the night. If the wildlings were coming, the wall would need every man. Gods know we have few enough. John looked at Pip and Keggs and Satin, Horse and Owen the Oaf, Tim Tangletongue, Molly, Spareboot, and the rest, and tried to imagine them going belly to belly and blade to blade against 100 screaming wildlings in the freezing darkness of that tunnel, with only a few iron bars between them. That was what it would come down to, unless they could stop the turtle before the gate was breached.
"It's big," Horse said.
Pip smacked his lips. "Think of all the soup it will make!" The jape was stillborn. Even Pip sounded tired. "He looks half-dead," John thought. "But so do we all." The king beyond the wall had so many men that he could throw fresh attackers at them every time. But the same handful of black brothers had to meet every assault, and it had worn them ragged. The men beneath the wood and hides would be pulling hard, John knew, putting their shoulders into it, straining to keep the wheels turning. But once the turtle was flush against the gate, they would exchange their ropes for axes. At least Mance was not sending his mammoths today. John was glad of that. Their awesome strength was wasted on the wall, and their size only made them easy targets. The last had been a day and a half in the dying. Its mournful trumpeting was terrible to hear. The turtle crept slowly through stones and stumps and brush. The earlier attacks had cost the free folk 100 lives or more. Most still lay where they had fallen. In the lulls the crows would come and pay them court, but now the birds fled screeching. They liked the look of that turtle no more than he did. Saturn, Horse, and the others were looking to him, John knew, waiting for his orders. He was so tired, he hardly knew any more. "The wall is mine," he reminded himself. "Owen, Horse, to the catapults. Keggs, you and Spareboot on the scorpions. The rest of you string your bows. Fire arrows. Let's see if we can burn it." It was likely to be a futile gesture, John knew, but it had to be better than standing helpless. Cumbersome and slow-moving, the turtle made for an easy shot, and his archers and crossbowmen soon turned it into a lumbering wooden hedgehog. But the wet hides protected it, just as they had the mantlets, and the flaming arrows gutted out almost as soon as they struck. John cursed under his breath. "Scorpions!" he commanded. "Catapults!" The scorpions' bolts punched deep into the pelts, but did no more damage than the fire arrows. The rocks went bouncing off the turtle's roof, leaving dimples in the thick layers of hides. A stone from one of the trebuchets might have crushed it, but the one machine was still broken, and the wildlings had gone wide around the area where the other dropped its loads. "John is still coming," said Owen the Oaf. He could see that for himself. Inch by inch, yard by yard, the turtle crept closer, rolling, rumbling, and rocking as it crossed the killing ground. Once the wildlings got it flush against the wall, it would give them all the shelter they needed whilst their axes crashed through the hastily repaired outer gates. Inside, under the ice, they would clear the loose rubble from the tunnel in a matter of hours, and then there would be nothing to stop them but two iron gates, a few half-frozen corpses, and whatever brothers John cared to throw in their path to fight and die down in the dark. To his left, the catapult made a thunk and filled the air with spinning stones. They plunked down on the turtle like hail and caromed harmlessly aside. The wilding archers were still loosing arrows from behind their mantlets. One thudded into the face of a straw man, and Pip said, "Four for Wat of Longlake. We have a tie." The next shaft whistled past his own ear, however. "Fie!" he shouted down. "I'm not in the tourney."
"The hides won't burn," John said, as much to himself as to the others. Their only hope was to try and crush the turtle when it reached the wall. For that they needed boulders. No matter how stoutly built the turtle was, a huge chunk of rock crashing straight down on top of it from 700 feet was bound to do some damage.
"Gren, Owen, Keggs, it's time."
Alongside the warming shed, a dozen stout oaken barrels were lined up in a row. They were full of crushed rock, the gravel that the Black Brothers customarily spread on the footpaths to give themselves better footing atop the wall. Yesterday, after he'd seen the free folk covering the turtle with sheepskins, John told Gren to pour water into the barrels, as much as they would take. The water would seep down through the crushed stone, and overnight the whole thing would freeze solid. It was the nearest thing to a boulder they were going to get.
"Why do we need to freeze it?" Gren had asked him. "Why don't we just roll the barrels off the way they are?"
John answered, "If they crash against the wall on the way down, they'll burst, and loose gravel will spray everywhere. We don't want to rain pebbles on the horses." He put his shoulder to the one barrel with Gren, while Keggs and Owen were wrestling with another. Together they rocked it back and forth to break the grip of the ice that had formed around its bottom.
"The bugger weighs a ton," said Gren.
"Tip it over and roll it," John said. "Careful. If it rolls over your foot, you'll end up like Spare Boot."
Once the barrel was on its side, John grabbed a torch and waved it above the surface of the wall, back and forth, just enough to melt the ice a little. The thin film of water helped the barrel roll more easily. Too easily, in fact. They almost lost it. But finally, with four of them pooling their efforts, they rolled their boulder to the edge and stood it up again. They had four of the big oak barrels lined up above the gate by the time Pip shouted, "There's a turtle at our door!" John braced his injured leg and leaned out for a look. Hoardings. Marsh should have built hoardings. So many things they should have done. The wildlings were dragging the dead giants away from the gate. Horse and Mully were dropping rocks down on them, and John thought he saw one man go down. But the stones were too small to have any effect on the turtle itself. He wondered what the free folk would do about the dead mammoth in the path. But then he saw. The turtle was almost as wide as a longhorn. So they simply pushed it over the carcass. His leg twitched, but Horse caught his arm and drew him back to safety.
"You shouldn't lean out like that," the boy said.
"We should have built hoardings." John thought he could hear the crash of axes on wood, but that was probably just fear ringing in his ears. He looked to Gren.
"Do it!"
Gren got behind a barrel, put his shoulder against it, grunted, and began to push. Owen and Mully moved to help him. They shoved the barrel out a foot, and then another, and suddenly it was gone. They heard the thump as it struck the wall on the way down, and then, much louder, the crash and crack of splintering wood, followed by shouts and screams. Satin whooped, and Owen the Oaf danced in circles, while Pip leaned out and called,
"The turtle was stuffed full of rabbits! Look at them hop away!" "Again!"
John barked, and Gren and Keggs slammed their shoulders against the next barrel and sent it tottering out into empty air. By the time they were done, the front of Mansus Turtle was a crushed and splintered ruin, and wildlings were spilling out the other end and scrambling for their camp. Satin scooped up his crossbow and set a few quarrels after them as they ran, to see them off the faster. Gren was grinning through his beard, Pip was making japes, and none of them would die today. On the morrow, though, John glanced toward the shed. 8 barrels of gravel remained, where 12 had stood a few moments before. He realized how tired he was then, and how much his wound was hurting. "I need to sleep, a few hours at least." He could go to Maester Aemon for some dream wine, that would help.
"I'm going down to the King's Tower," he told them.
Call me if Mance gets up to anything. Pip, you have the wall.
Me? Said Pip.
Him? Said Gren. Smiling, he left them to it and rode down in the cage. A cup of dream wine did help, as it happened. No sooner had he stretched out on the narrow bed in his cell than sleep took him. His dreams were strange and formless, full of strange voices, shouts and cries, and the sound of a war horn blowing low and loud, a single deep booming note that lingered in the air. When he awoke, the sky was black outside the arrow slit that served him for a window, and four men he did not know were standing over him. One held a lantern.
"John Snow," the tallest of them said brusquely, "pull on your boots and come with us."
His first groggy thought was that somehow the wall had fallen whilst he'd slept, that Man's raider had sent more giants or another turtle and broken through the gate. But when he rubbed his eyes, he saw that the strangers were all in black. "They're men of the Night's Watch," John realized.
"Come where? Who are you?"
The tall man gestured, and two of the others pulled John from the bed. With a lantern leading the way, they marched him from his cell and up a half-turn of stair to the old bear's solar. He saw Maester Aemon standing by the fire, his hands folded around the head of a blackthorn cane. Septon Celador was half-drunk, as usual, and Sir Winton Stout was asleep in a window-seat. The other brothers were strangers to him. All but one. Immaculate in his fur-trimmed cloak and polished boots, Sir Alistair Thorne turned to say,
"Here's a turncloak now, my lord. Ned Stark's bastard, of Winterfell."
"I'm no turncloak, Thorne," John said coldly.
"We shall see."
In the leather chair behind the table where the old bear wrote his letters sat a big, broad, jowly man John did not know.
"Yes, we shall see," he said again. "You will not deny that you are John Snow, I hope. Stark's bastard. Lord Snow, he likes to call himself."
Sir Alistair was a spare, slim man, compact and sinewy, and just now his flinty eyes were dark with amusement.
"You're the one who named me Lord Snow," said John.
Sir Alistair had been fond of naming the boys he trained during his time as Castle Black's master-at-arms. The old bear had sent Thorne to Eastwatch by the sea. These others must be Eastwatch men. The bird reached Cutter Pike, and he sent us help. "How many men have you brought?" he asked the man behind the table.
"It's me who'll ask the questions,"
the jolly man replied.
"You've been charged with oath-breaking, cowardice, and desertion, John Snow. Do you deny that you abandoned your brothers to die on the fist of the first men, and join the wildling Mance Rayder, this self-styled king beyond the wall?"
"Abandon?" John almost choked on the word. Maester Aemon spoke up then.
"My lord, Donald Noy and I discussed these issues when John Snow first returned to us, and were satisfied by John's explanations."
"Well, I am not satisfied, Maester," said the jolly man. "I will hear these explanations for myself. Yes, I will."
John swallowed his anger.
"I abandoned no one. I left the Fist with Corrin Halfhand to scout the Skirling Pass. I joined the wildlings under orders. The Halfhand feared that Mance might have found the Horn of Winter."
"The Horn of Winter?" Sir Alistair chuckled. "Were you commanded to count their snarks as well, Lord Snow?"
"No, but I counted their giants as best I could."
"Sir," snapped the jolly man, "you will address Sir Alistair as Sir, and myself as my lord. I am Janus Slint, Lord of Harrenhal, and commander here at Castle Black, until such time as Bourne Marsh returns with his garrison. You will grant us our courtesies, yes? I will not suffer to hear an anointed knight like the good Sir Alistair mocked by a traitor's bastard."
He raised a hand and pointed a meaty finger at John's face. "Do you deny that you took a wildling woman into your bed?"
"No," John's grief over Ygritte was too fresh for him to deny her now.
No, my lord.
I suppose it was also the half-hand who commanded you to fuck this unwashed whore,
Sir Alistair asked with a smirk.
Sir, she was no whore,
sir.
The half-hand told me not to balk whatever the wildlings asked of me, but I will not deny that I went beyond what I had to do, that I cared for her.
You admit to being an oath-breaker, then,
said Jaina Slint. Half the men at Castle Black visited Molestown from time to time to dig for buried treasure in the brothel, John knew, but he would not dishonour Ygritte by equating her with the Molestown whores. I broke my vows with a woman. I admit that, yes.
Yes, my lord.
When Slint scowled, his jowls quivered. He was as broad as the old bear had been, and no doubt would be as bald if he lived to Mormont's age. Half his hair was gone already, though he could not have been more than 40.
Yes, my lord,
John said. I rode with the wildlings and ate with them, as the half-hand commanded me, and I shared my furs with Ygritte. But I swear to you, I never turned my cloak. I escaped the Magnar as soon as I could, and never took up arms against my brothers or the realm.
Lord Slint's small eyes studied him.
Sir Glendon, he commanded, bring in the other prisoner.
Sir Glendon was the tall man who had dragged John from his bed. Four other men went with him when he left the room. But they were back soon enough with a captive, a small, sallow, battered man, fettered hand and foot. He had a single eyebrow, a widow's peak, and a moustache that looked like a smear of dirt on his upper lip. But his face was swollen and mottled with bruises, and most of his front teeth had been knocked out. The East Watchmen threw the captive roughly to the floor. Lord Slint frowned down on him.
Is this the one you spoke of?
The captive blinked yellow eyes.
Aye.
Not until that instant did John recognize Rattleshirt. He is a different man without his armor, he thought.
Aye. The wildling repeated. He's the craven. Kill the half-hand. Up in a frost fangs, it were. After we'd hunted down t'other crows. And killed them, everyone. We would have done for this one, too, only he begged for his worthless life. Offered to join us, if we'd have him. The half-hand swore he'd see the craven dead first, but the wolf ripped Corrin half to pieces, and this one opened his throat.
He gave John a crack-tooth smile then, and spat blood on his foot.
"Well,"
Jaina Slint demanded of John harshly, "do you deny it, or will you claim Corrin commanded you to kill him?"
"He told me,"
the words came hard,
"he told me to do whatever they asked of me."
Slint looked about the solar at the other East Watchmen.
"Does this boy think I fell off a turnip wagon onto my head?"
"Your lies won't save you now, Lord Snow," warned Sir Alistair Thorne. "We'll have the truth from you, bastard."
"I've told you the truth. Our garrons were failing, and Rattleshirt was close behind us. Corrin told me to pretend to join the wildlings. You must not balk whatever is asked of you," he said. "He knew they would make me kill him. Rattleshirt was going to kill him anyway. He knew that, too."
"So now you claim the great Corrin Halfhand feared this creature?"
Slint looked at Rattleshirt and snorted.
"All men fear the Lord of Bounds,"
the wildling grumbled. Sir Glendon kicked him, and he lapsed back into silence.
"I never said that," John insisted.
Slint slammed a fist on the table.
"I heard you. Sir Alistair had your measure true enough, it seems. You lie through your bastard teeth. Well, I will not suffer it. I will not. You might have fooled this crippled blacksmith, but not Jaina Slint. Oh, no, Jaina Slint does not swallow lies so easily. D'ye think my skull was stuffed with cabbage?"
"I don't know what your skull is stuffed with, my lord."
"Lord Snow is nothing if not arrogant," said Sir Alistair. "He murdered Corrin just as his fellow turncloaks did Lord Marmont. It would not surprise me to learn that it was all part of the same fell plot. Benjen Stark may well have had a hand in all this as well. For all we know, he's sitting in Mansraider's tent even now. You know these Starks, my lord?
I do, said Janus Slint. I know them too well.
John peeled off his glove and showed them his burned hand. I burned my hand defending Lord Mormont from a wight, and my uncle was a man of honour. He would never have betrayed his vows.
No more than you, mocked Sir Alistair.
Septon Celador cleared his throat.
Lord Slint, he said, this boy refused to swear his vows properly in the sept, but went beyond the wall to see his words before a heart tree. His father's gods, he said, but they are a wildling gods as well. They are the gods of the north, Septon.
Maester Aemon was courteous but firm.
My lords, when Donald Noy was slain, it was this young man, John Snow, who took the wall and held it against all the fury of the north. He has proved himself valiant, loyal, and resourceful. Were it not for him, you would have found Mansraider sitting here when you arrived, Lord Slint. You are doing him a great wrong. John Snow was Lord Mormont's own steward and squire. He was chosen for that duty because the Lord Commander saw much promise in him, as do I.
Promise? Said Slint. Well, promise may turn false. Corran Halfhand's blood is on his hands. Mormont trusted him, you see. But what of that? I know what it is to be betrayed by men you trusted. Oh, yes. And I know the ways of wolves as well.
He pointed at John's face. Your father died a traitor.
My father was murdered. John was past caring what they did to him. But he would not suffer any more lies about his father. Slint purpled.
Murder? You insolent pup. King Robert was not even called when Lord Eddard moved against his son.
He rose to his feet, a shorter man than Mormont, but thick about the chest and arms with a gut to match. A small gold spear tipped with red enamel pinned his cloak at the shoulder.
Your father died by the sword, but he was highborn, a king's hand. For you, a noose will serve. Sir Alistair, take this turned cloak to an ice cell.
My lord is wise.
Sir Alistair seized John by the arm. John yanked away and grabbed the knight by the throat with such ferocity that he lifted him off the floor. He would have throttled him if the East Watch men had not pulled him off. Thorn staggered back, rubbing the marks John's fingers had left on his neck.
You see for yourselves, brothers. The boy is a wildling.
Tyrion. When dawn broke, he found he could not face the thought of food.
By evenfall, I may stand condemned.
His belly was acid with bile, and his nose itched. Tyrion scratched at it with the point of his knife.
One last witness to endure, then my turn.
But what to do? Deny everything? Accuse Sansa and Sir Dontus? Confess in the hope of spending the rest of his days on the wall? Let the dice fly, and pray the Red Viper could defeat Sir Gregor Clegane? Tyrion stabbed listlessly at a greasy grey sausage, wishing it were his sister.
It is bloody cold on the wall, but at least I would be shut of Cersei.
He did not think he would make much of a ranger, but the Night's Watch needed clever men as well as strong ones. Lord Commander Mormont has said as much when Tyrion had visited Castle Black. There are those inconvenient vows, though. It would mean the end of his marriage, and whatever claim he might ever have made for Castle Rock. But he did not seem destined to enjoy either in any case, and he seemed to recall that there was a brothel in a nearby village. It was not a life he'd ever dreamed of, but it was life. And all he had to do to earn it was trust in his father, stand up on his little stunted legs and say, "Yes, I did it. I confess." That was the part that tied his vows in knots. He almost wished he had done it,
since it seemed he must suffer for it anyway.
"My lord," said Podrick Payne, "they're here, my lord, Sir Adam and the gold cloaks. They wait without."
"Pod, tell me true. Do you think I did it?"
The boy hesitated. When he tried to speak, all he managed to produce was a weak sputter.
"I am doomed," Tyrion sighed. "No need to answer. You've been a good squire to me, better than I deserved. Whatever happens, I thank you for your leal service."
Sir Adam Marbrand waited at the door with 6 gold cloaks. He had nothing to say this morning, it seemed. "Another good man who thinks me a kinslayer." Tyrion summoned all the dignity he could find and waddled down the steps. He could feel them all watching him as he crossed the yard, the guards on the walls, the grooms by the stables, the scullions and washerwomen and serving girls. Inside the throne room, knights and lordlings moved aside to let them through and whispered to their ladies. No sooner had Tyrion taken his place before the judges than another group of gold cloaks led in Shay. A cold hand tightened round his heart.
"Varys betrayed her," he thought.
Then he remembered.
"No, I betrayed her myself. I should have left her with Lollis. Of course they'd question Sansa's maids. I'd do the same."
Tyrion rubbed at the slick scar where his nose had been, wondering why Cersei had bothered.
"She knows nothing that can hurt me."
"They plotted it together," she said.
This girl he'd loved.
"The imp and Lady Sansa plotted it after the young wolf died. Sansa wanted revenge for her brother, and Tyrion meant to have the throne. He was going to kill his sister next, and then his own lord father, so he could be hand for Prince Tommen. But after a year or so, before Tommen got too old, he would have killed him too, so as to take the crown for his own head."
"How could you know all this?"
demanded Prince Oberyn.
"Why would the imp divulge such plans to his wife's maid?" "I overheard some, my lord," said Shay, "and my lady let things slip too. But most I had from his own lips. I wasn't only Lady Sansa's maid. I was his whore, all the time he was here in King's Landing. On the morning of the wedding, he dragged me down where they kept the dragon skulls, and fucked me there with the monsters all around. And when I cried, he said I ought to be more grateful that it wasn't every girl who got to be the king's whore. That was when he told me how he meant to be king. He said that poor boy Joffrey would never know his bride the way he was knowing me."
She started sobbing then.
"I never meant to be a whore, my lord. I was to be married. A squire he was, and a good brave boy, gentle-born. But the imp saw me at the Green Fork, and put the boy I meant to marry in the front rank of the van. And after he was killed, he sent his wildlings to bring me to his tent. Shagger, the big one, and Timmit with a burned eye. He said if I didn't pleasure him, he'd give me to them. So I did. And then he brought me to the city, so I'd be close when he wanted me. He made me do such shameful things."
Prince Oberyn looked curious.
"What sort of things?"
"Unspeakable things."
As the tears rolled slowly down that pretty face, no doubt every man in the hall wanted to take Shay in his arms and comfort her.
"With my mouth and other parts, my lord. All my parts. He used me every way there was, and he used to make me tell him how big he was. My giant, I had to call him. My giant of Lannister."
Oswald Kettleblack was the first to laugh. Boris and Meryn joined in, then Cersei, Sir Loras, and more lords and ladies than he could count. The sudden gale of mirth made the rafters ring and shook the Iron Throne.
"It's true," Shay protested. "My giant of Lannister."
The laughter swelled twice as loud. Their mouths were twisted in merriment. Their bellies shook. Some laughed so hard that snot flew from their nostrils.
I saved you all. Tyrion thought, I saved this vile city and all your worthless lives. There were hundreds in that throne room, every one of them laughing, but his father, or so it seemed. Even the red viper chortled, and Mace Tyrell looked like to bust a gut. But Lord Tywin Lannister sat between them, as if made of stone, his fingers steepled beneath his chin. Tyrion pushed forward. My lords! He shouted. He had to shout to have any hope of being heard. His father raised a hand. Bit by bit, the hall grew silent.
Get this lying whore out of my sight, said Tyrion, and I will give you your confession.
Lord Tywin nodded, gestured. Shay looked half in terror as the gold cloaks formed up around her. Her eyes met Tyrion's as they marched her from the wall. Was it shame he saw there, or fear? He wondered what Cersei had promised her. You will get the gold or jewels, whatever it was you asked for, he thought, as he watched her back recede. But before the moon has turned, she'll have you entertaining the gold cloaks in their barracks.
Tyrion stared up at his father's hard green eyes with their flecks of coal-bright gold.
Guilty, he said. So guilty. Is that what you wanted to hear?
Lord Tywin said nothing. Mace Tyrell nodded. Prince Oberyn looked mildly disappointed.
You admit you poisoned the king.
Nothing of the sort, said Tyrion. Of Joffrey's death I am innocent. I am guilty of a more monstrous crime. He took a step toward his father. I was born. I lived. I am guilty of being a dwarf. I confess it. And no matter how many times my good father forgave me, I have persisted in my infamy.
This is folly, Tyrion, declared Lord Tywin. Speak to the matter in hand. You are not on trial for being a dwarf.
That is where you err, my lord. I have been on trial for being a dwarf my entire life.
Have you nothing to say in your defense?
Nothing but this. I did not do it. Yet now I wish I had.
He turned to face the hall, that sea of pale faces.
I wish I had enough poison for you all. You make me sorry that I am not the monster you would have me be. Yet there it is. I am innocent, but I will get no justice here. You leave me no choice but to appeal to the gods. I demand trial by battle.
Have you taken leave of your wits? His father said.
No. I found them. I demand trial by battle.
His sweet sister could not have been more pleased.
He has that right, my lord, she reminded the judges. Let the gods judge. Sir Gregor Clegane will stand for Joffrey. He returned to the city the night before last to put his sword at my service.
Lord Tywin's face was so dark that for half a heartbeat Tyrion wondered if he'd drunk some poison wine as well. He slammed his fist down on the table, too angry to speak. It was Mace Tyrell who turned to Tyrion and asked the question.
Do you have a champion to defend your innocence?
He does, my lord. Prince Oberyn of Dorne rose to his feet.
The dwarf has quite convinced me.
The uproar was deafening. Tyrion took especial pleasure in the sudden doubt he glimpsed in Cersei's eyes. It took 100 gold cloaks pounding the butts of their spears against the floor to quiet the throne room again. By then, Lord Tywin Lannister had recovered himself.
Let the issue be decided on the morrow, he declared in iron tones. I wash my hands of it.
He gave his dwarf son a cold, angry look, then strode from the hall, out of the king's door, behind the iron throne, his brother Kevin at his side. Later, back in his tower cell, Tyrion poured himself a cup of wine and sent Podrick Payne off for cheese, bread, and olives. He doubted whether he could keep down anything heavier just now. "Do you think I would go meekly, father?" he asked the shadow
his candles etched upon the wall. "I have too much of you in me for that." He felt strangely at peace, now that he had snatched the power of life and death from his father's hands and placed it in the hands of the gods. Assuming there are gods, and they give a mummer's fart. If not, then I'm in Dornish hands. No matter what happened, Tyrion had the satisfaction of knowing that he'd kicked Lord Tywin's plans to splinters. If Prince Oberyn won, it would further inflame Highgarden against the Dornish. Mace Tyrell would see the man who'd crippled his son helping the dwarf who almost poisoned his daughter to escape his rightful punishment. And if the Mountain triumphed, Dorin Martell might well demand to know why his brother had been served with death instead of the justice Tyrion had promised him. Dorn might crown Marcella after all. It was almost worth dying to know all the trouble he'd made. "Will you come to see the end, she? Will you stand there with the rest, watching as Sir Ilion lops my ugly head off? Will you miss your giant of Lannister when he's dead?" He drained his wine, flung the cup aside, and sang lustily. "He rode through the streets of the city, down from his hill on high. O'er the wynds and the steps and the cobbles, he rode to a woman's sigh. For she was his secret treasure, she was his shame and his bliss, and a chain and a keep are nothing compared to a woman's kiss." Sir Kevin did not visit him that night. He was probably with Lord Tywin, trying to placate the Tyrells. "I have seen the last of that uncle, I fear." He poured another cup of wine. "A pity it had Simon Silvertongue killed before learning all the words of that song. It wasn't a bad song, if truth be told, especially compared to the ones that would be written about him henceforth. For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm," he sang. "Perhaps he should write the other verses himself, if he lives so long." That night, surprisingly, Tyrion Lannister slept long and deep. He rose at first light, well rested, and with a hearty appetite, and broke his fast on fried bread, blood sausage, apple cakes, and a double helping of eggs, cooked with onions and fiery Dornish peppers. Then he begged leave of his guards to attend his champion. Sir Adam gave his consent. Tyrion found Prince Oberon drinking a cup of red wine as he donned his armour. He was attended by four of his younger Dornish lordlings. "Good morrow to you, my lord," the prince said. "Will you take a cup of wine?"
"Should you be drinking before battle?"
"I always drink before battle."
"That could get you killed. Worse, it could get me killed."
Prince Oberon laughed.
"The gods defend the innocent. You are innocent, I trust."
"Only of killing Joffrey," Tyrion admitted. "I do hope you know what you're about to face. Gregor Clegane is
large, so I've heard.
He is almost 8 feet tall, and must weigh 30 stone, all of it muscle. He fights with a two-handed greatsword, but needs only one hand to wield it. He has been known to cut men in half with a single blow. His armor is so heavy that no lesser man could bear the weight, let alone move in it."
Prince Oberon was unimpressed.
"I have killed large men before. The trick is to get them off their feet. Once they go down, they're dead."
The Dornishman sounded so blithely confident that Tyrion felt almost reassured, until he turned and said,
"Daemon, my spear."
Sir Daemon tossed it to him, and the red viper snatched it from the air.
"You mean to face the mountain with a spear?"
That made Tyrion uneasy all over again. In battle, ranks of mass spears made a formidable front, but single combat against a skilled swordsman was a very different matter.
"We are fond of spears in Dorne. Besides, it's the only way to counter his reach. Have a look, Lord Imp, but see you do not touch."
The spear was turned ash, 8 feet long, the shaft smooth, thick, and heavy. The last 2 feet of that was steel.
a slender leaf-shaped spearhead narrowing to a wicked spike. The edges looked sharp enough to shave with. When Oberon spun the haft between the palms of his hand, they glistened black.
Oil or poison?
Tyrion decided that he would sooner not know.
I hope you are good with that, he said doubtfully.
You will have no cause for complaint, though Sir Gregor may. However thick his plate, there will be gaps at the joints, inside the elbow and knee, beneath the arms. I will find a place to tickle him, I promise you.
He set the spear aside.
It is said that a Lannister always pays his debts. Perhaps you will return to Sunspear with me when the day's bloodletting is done. My brother Doran would be most pleased to meet the rightful heir to Castle Rock, especially if he brought his lovely wife, the Lady of Winterfell.
Does the snake think I have Sansa squirreled away somewhere, like a nut I'm hoarding for winter?
If so, Tyrion was not about to disabuse him.
A trip to Dorne might be very pleasant now that I reflect on it.
Plan on a lengthy visit.
Prince Oberon sipped his wine.
You and Doran have many matters of mutual interest to discuss. Music, trade, history, wine, the dwarf's penny, the laws of inheritance and succession. No doubt an uncle's counsel would be of benefit to Queen Marcella in the trying times ahead.
If Varys had his little birds listening, Oberon was giving them a ripe earful.
"I believe I will have that cup of wine," said Tyrion.
"Queen Marcella?"
It would have been more tempting if only he did have Sansa tucked under his cloak.
If she declared for Marcella over Tommen, would the North follow?
What the Red Viper was hinting at was treason. Could Tyrion truly take up arms against Tommen, against his own father?
Cersei would spit blood.
It might be worth it for that alone.
"Do you recall the tale I told you of our first meeting, Imp?"
Prince Oberon asked, as the bastard of God's grace knelt before him to fasten his greaves.
"It was not for your tale alone that my sister and I came to Castle Rock. We were on a quest of sorts, a quest that took us to Starfall, the Arbor, Old Town, the Shield Islands, Craighall, and finally Castle Rock. But our true destination was marriage. Doran was betrothed to Lady Melario of Norvos, so he had been left behind as Castellan of Sunspear. My sister and I were yet unpromised. Elia found it all exciting. She was of that age, and her delicate health had never permitted her much travel. I preferred to amuse myself by mocking my sister's suitors. There was Little Lord Lazy Eye, Squire Squish Lips, one I named the Whale That Walks, that sort of thing. The only one who was even halfway presentable was young Baelor Hightower. A pretty lad, and my sister was half in love with him until he had the misfortune to fart once in our presence. I promptly named him Baelor Breakwind, and after that Elia couldn't look at him without laughing. I was a monstrous young fellow. Someone should have sliced out my vile tongue.
Yes, Tyrion agreed silently. Baelor Hightower was no longer young, but he remained Lord Leighton's heir, wealthy, handsome, and a knight of splendid repute. Baelor Brightsmile, they called him now. Had Elia wed him in place of Rhaegar Targaryen, she might be in Old Town with her children growing tall around her. He wondered how many lives had been snuffed out by that fart.
Lannisport was the end of our voyage,
Prince Oberon went on, as Sir Aaron Corgill helped him into a padded leather tunic and began lacing it up the back.
Were you aware that our mothers knew each other of old?
They had been at court together as girls, I seem to recall, companions to Princess Rhaella.
Just so. It was my belief that the mothers had cooked up this plot between them. Squire Squishlips and his ilk, and the various pimply young maidens who'd been paraded before me, were the almonds before the feast, meant only to whet our appetites. The main course was to be served at Castle Rock.
Cersei, and Jaime.
Such a clever dwarf. Elia and I were older, to be sure. Your brother and sister could not have been more than 8 or 9. Still, a difference of 5 or 6 years is little enough. And there was an empty cabin on our ship. A very nice cabin, such as might be kept for a person of high birth. As if it were intended that we take someone back to Sunspear. A young page, perhaps, or a companion for Elia. Your lady mother meant to betroth Jaime to my sister, or Cersei to me. Perhaps both.
Perhaps, said Tyrion. But my father ruled the 7 kingdoms, but was ruled at home by his lady wife, or so my mother always said. Prince Oberon raised his arm so Lord Dagos Manwoody and the bastard of God's grace could slip a chainmail burnie down over his head.
At Old Town we learned of your mother's death and the monstrous child she had borne. We might have turned back there, but my mother chose to sail on. I told you of the welcome we found at Casterly Rock. What I did not tell you was that my mother waited as long as was decent and then broached your father about our purpose. Years later, on her deathbed, she told me that Lord Tywin had refused us brusquely. His daughter was meant for Prince Rhaegar, he informed her. And when she asked for Jaime to espouse Elia, he offered her you instead. Which of her she took for an outrage. It was, even you can see that surely.
Oh, surely. It all goes back and back, Tyrion thought, to our mothers and fathers and theirs before them. We are puppets dancing on the strings of those who came before us. And one day our own children will take up our strings and dance on in our steads. Well, Prince Rhaegar married Elia of Dorne, not Cersei Lannister of Casterly Rock, so it would seem your mother won that tilt.
She thought so, Prince Oberon agreed. But your father is not a man to forget such slights. He taught that lesson to Lord and Lady Tarbeck once, and to the Reigns of Castamere. And at King's Landing he taught it to my sister. My helm, Dagos!
Manwoody handed it to him, a high golden helm with a copper disc mounted on the brow, the Sun of Dawn. The visor had been removed, Tyrion saw.
Elia and her children have waited long for justice.
Prince Oberon pulled on soft red leather gloves and took up his spear again. But this day they shall have it. The Otter Ward had been chosen for the combat. Tyrion had to skip and run to keep up with Prince Oberon's long strides. The snake is eager, he thought. Let us hope he is venomous as well. The day was grey and windy. The sun was struggling to break through the clouds, but Tyrion could no more have said who was going to win that fight than the one on which his life depended. It looked as though 1,000 people had come to see if he would live or die. They lined the castle wall walks and elbowed one another on the steps of keeps and towers. They watched from the stable doors, from windows and bridges, from balconies and roofs. And the yard was packed with them, so many that the gold cloaks and the knights of the King's Guard had to shove them back to make enough room for the fight. Some had dragged out chairs to watch more comfortably, while others perched on barrels.
"We should have done this in the dragon pit," Tyrion thought sourly.
"We could have charged a penny a head and paid for Joffrey's wedding and funeral both." Some of the onlookers even had small children sitting on their shoulders to get a better view. They shouted and pointed at the sight of Tyrion. Cersei seemed half a child herself, beside Sir Gregor. In his armour the mountain looked bigger than any man had any right to be. Beneath a long yellow surcoat, bearing the 3 black dogs of Clegane, he wore heavy plate over chainmail, dull, grey steel, dinted and scarred in battle. Beneath that would be boiled leather and a layer of quilting. A flat-top great helm was bolted to his gorget, with breaths around the mouth and nose and a narrow slit for vision. The crest atop it was a stone fist. If Sir Gregor was suffering from wounds, Tyrion could see no sign of it from across the yard. He looks as though he was chiseled out of rock, standing there. His great sword was planted in the ground before him, 6 feet of scarred metal. Sir Gregor's huge hands, clad in gauntlets of lobstered steel, clasped the cross-hilt to either side of the grip. Even Prince Oberon's paramour paled at the sight of him.
"You are going to fight that?"
Ilaria Sand said in a hushed voice.
"I am going to kill that,"
her lover replied carelessly. Tyrion had his own doubts, now that they stood on the brink. When he looked at Prince Oberon, he found himself wishing he had Bronn defending him, or even better, Jaime. The Red Viper was lightly armoured, greaves, vambraces, gorget, spalder, steel codpiece. Elsewise, Oberon was clad in supple leather and flowing silks. Over his burnie he wore his scales of gleaming copper, but mail and scale together would not give him a quarter the protection of Gregor's heavy plate. With its visor removed, the prince's helm was effectively no better than a half-helm, lacking even a nasal. His round steel shield was brightly polished, and showed the sun and spear in red gold, yellow gold, white gold, and copper. "Dance around him until he's so tired he can hardly lift his arm. Then put him on his back." The Red Viper seemed to have the same notion as Bronn. But the sellsword had been blunt about the risks of such tactics. "I hope to Seven Hills that you know what you're doing, snake." A platform had been erected beside the Tower of the Hand, halfway between the two champions. That was where Lord Tywin sat with his brother Sir Kevin. King Tommen was not in evidence. For that, at least, Tyrion was grateful. Lord Tywin glanced briefly at his dwarf son, then lifted his hand. A dozen trumpeters blew a fanfare to quiet the crowd. The High Septon shuffled forward in his tall crystal crown, and prayed that the Father above would help them in this judgment, and that the warrior would lend his strength through the arm of the man whose cause was just.
"That would be me!"
Tyrion almost shouted. But they would only laugh, and he was sick unto death of laughter. Sir Osmond Kettleblack brought Clegane his shield, a massive thing of heavy oak, rimmed in black iron. As the mountain slid his left arm through the straps, Tyrion saw that the hounds of Clegane had been painted over. This morning Sir Gregor bore the seven-pointed star the Andals had brought to Westeros, when they crossed the narrow sea to overwhelm the first men and their gods.
"Very pious of you, Cersei, but I doubt the guards will be impressed."
There were 50 yards between them. Prince Oberon advanced quickly, Sir Gregor more ominously. "The ground does not shake when he walks," Tyrion told himself. "That is only my art fluttering." When the two men were 10 yards apart, the Red Viper stopped and called out,
"Have they told you who I am?"
Sir Gregor grunted through his breaths.
"Some dead man,"
he came on, inexorable. The Dornish man slid sideways.
"I am Oberon Martell, a prince of Dorne," he said, as the mountain turned to keep him in sight. "Princess Elia was my sister."
"Who?"
asked Gregor Clegane. Oberon's long spear jabbed, but Sir Gregor took the point on his shield, shoved it aside, and bowled back at the prince, his great sword flashing. The Dornishman spun away untouched. The spear darted forward. Clegane slashed at it. Martell snapped it back, then thrust again. Metal screamed on metal, as the spearhead slid off the mountain's chest, slicing through the surcoat and leaving a long bright scratch on the steel beneath.
"Elia Martell, Princess of Dorne," the Red Viper hissed. "You raped her. You murdered her. You killed her children."
Sir Gregor grunted. He made a ponderous charge to hack at the Dornishman's head. Prince Oberon avoided him easily.
"You raped her. You murdered her. You killed her children.
Did you come to talk or to fight?"
"I came to hear you confess."
The Red Viper landed a quick thrust on the mountain's belly, to no effect. Gregor cut at him and missed. The long spear lanced in above his sword. Like a serpent's tongue, it flicked in and out, feinting low and landing high, jabbing